So what I'm supposed to be talking about here is the real state of the economy. And obviously we try to keep these remarks short just to intrigue you and just give you a taste. And so here, there's different levels of understanding in the crowd. There are some people, many of you have been reading Rothbard's books for decades, and others, this might be your first time at a Mises Institute event. So I'll try to just cater to both groups. So I'm gonna just give you a quick overview of what's called Austrian business cycle theory. And so this guy right here is Ludwig von Mises. So if you wonder why is there an institute named after this guy, I mean, just look at him. He needs to have an institute named after him. Look at how impressive he is. You gonna tell him no? I don't think so. All right. So here's the overview. So this is the theory of what causes the boom bust cycle. Like why are there recessions? Why was there a depression? So this guy, Ludwig von Mises, developed this theory. It was elaborated upon by Friedrich Hayek. Many of you have heard him. He won the Nobel Prize in economics largely for his work in fleshing out this theory. So I'll just give you the quick overview, and then I'll take that framework and try to show you where are we right now in 2019 vis-a-vis this framework that Mises and Hayek developed. So the opening thing is that the banking system, especially under the central bank, floods the market with unbacked credit. So you see this happen every time there's a downturn. How does the press report it? And they say, oh, well, the Fed cut interest rates. And the way we've all been taught, and this gets to what David was saying about the officially approved knowledge, I can certainly say in my realm of economics that the official prescriptions and the system that's been established, it's not merely that it doesn't help when there's a quote bad economy. As you'll see here, the very boom-bust cycle is itself driven by the things that the official institutions do, and the public thinks all they're trying to help, and there's these exogenous forces that just keep hitting us coming out of nowhere, or maybe because people save too much and do silly things like that. And thank goodness we have the central bank there to slash interest rates when people aren't spending enough. Because as we, and so just think through the logic. Let me just take a minute here to contrast this. So the Austrian school, named after, of course, the fact that Mises and others, originally Karl Menger, were from Austria, that their primary opposite in today's world was the Keynesian school. And the Keynesian school is motivated by the idea that the business cycle is driven by spending. All right, I'm diluting it now just for the purpose of this talk. But the idea, and you see this all the time, right? Like in November, early December, you might see a report saying economists are concerned that consumer spending is only up 2.6% since last quarter, and it's not sure if retailers are going to be able to make it through the Christmas season. And you get the idea that if only we had Christmas every month, we would never have a downturn, right? The only bad thing that could ever happen is if people didn't blow their paycheck every 2 weeks at the mall, then we would always have full employment. Right, so deep down, everybody kind of knows that can't be right. Like in your own household, to save, to live below your means, right, to not consume your full income each period is actually a smart thing to do, right? You build up a cushion, you build up savings. The individual household or a corporation, imagine a corporation that every quarter was running up debt, that can't be a good thing to do, right? And yet in Keynesianism, somehow they've extrapolated, but when the whole economy saves, then they get the so-called paradox of thrift. Okay, that's an actual phrase in the Keynesian literature. Okay, so the Austrians are the opposite of that. Okay, so in their view, what happens is the banking system floods the market with unbacked credit. So what I mean is when the Fed cuts interest rates, it's not because Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen or now Powell, take out their piggy bank. They've been cutting lawns for 20 years and saved up a bunch of money, and now they're gonna lend that out. That's not how the Fed cuts interest rates. It just creates money electronically out of nothing. And that's how it lowers interest rates, right? So there's more loans being made even though people haven't saved more. And so that's one way of seeing what the Austrian view is that there's a mismatch there. That's not a good thing. You're setting us up for a big crash. Okay, and so interest rates get pushed down to artificial lows when the system pushes in unbacked credit. And one way to think about this is that in the Austrian view, interest rates are prices, right? So imagine if the government somehow made it so that the price of a barrel of crude oil was $5, right? At least in the short term, that might seem like a good thing, right? Gasoline would be really cheap, airline tickets would be cheap because the cost of fuel would come down. But you can see how if the way they made the price of crude oil $5 a barrel, if it's because they found more oil, well, then that would be great. That would be genuine prosperity, and the new price would signal the actual scarcity involved, and people would drive more, people would take more flights. But if actually the supply of oil hadn't increased and they just artificially somehow made it so you could buy oil at $5 a barrel, you can see how quickly that would, we'd run out of available oil deposits, right? People would be consuming more than was being brought to market, and pretty soon there'd be shortages. And so, yeah, if you could afford gas at the pump, it'd be great. You could fill up just for a few, you know, a few dollars, you could fill up your van, except all the gas stations would say we're out of fuel, right? And some of you might remember in the 70s, that's what did happen. Okay, and again, that, just as an aside, what happened, the reason there were lines at the pumps in the 70s was not because of OPEC countries embargoing the U.S., it was because the U.S. government put in place price controls. If the supply of oil shrinks, then the price can go up and it's more expensive, but that's the way it gets rationed in a market. Okay, the lines are when the price is held below what the market clearing level is. So likewise here, interest rates, if you got the analogy you did with oil there, what happens if the interest rate is artificially low? What if the interest rate is supposed to be 5%, but the Fed pushes it down to 1%? Again, it might seem like that's doing us a favor. Oh, now we can go borrow money, or businesses can borrow and build new factories on cheaper terms, and that's good because we promote investment, but that's analogous to saying, oh, that's good, consumers can drive now more cheaply, or airline tickets are cheaper because crude oil is only $5 now. If that doesn't correspond to the actual reality, it screws everything up. People can't plan properly when the price is wrong. So same thing, when interest rates are artificially low, that doesn't do us any favors. What happens is businesses all start long-term projects thinking erroneously that, oh, the cost of capital is now, whatever, 1% when it really should be 5%, and that screws things up if the price is wrong, right? So what it does is it creates a temporary boom period, but it's built on an illusion. Okay, so obviously for a talk like this with the time constraints I have, I can't elaborate on this, but this is the idea that Mises and Hayek spelled out, was that artificially low interest rates give this appearance of prosperity, right? That people, consumers are spending more, they're going to the mall more, they're, you know, going to fancy restaurants, they're buying sports cars, plasma screen TVs. In our times more recently, nice new houses, right? When mortgage rates come down to historic lows, people can afford more house, right? And that's what they do. But if that's not based on the fact that Americans are saving more, and that certainly was not happening. In the early 2000s, the U.S. savings rate, depending on the statistics you looked at, went negative for certain years, right? And so that's, you know, showing you that it's these low interest rates are not because of more saving, it was because of something artificial. And so that's going to create this temporary illusion of prosperity, but it's built on quicksand. And so then the last leg is ultimately the banks relent. So in our modern framework, if price inflation starts rising, the central bank might get skittish and say, okay, we really need to start raising rates now. We got to take our foot off the gas, whatever sort of metaphor they use. And then when that new credit stops flowing in as much, interest rates rise, and then entrepreneurs collectively slap their heads and say, oh, wow, we were too aggressive. We need to scale back. And so then that leads into the crash period. So one way of understanding this is to say, you know, the thing that needs to be explained is why are there these periods where all the businesses or many of the businesses all seem to make mistakes at the same time? Okay, because it's not surprising. Any given entrepreneur might be overly optimistic. They might start a project, they, you know, buy a storefront or rent a storefront, hire a bunch of workers, they start making a product, and they try it for 6 months, a year, 2 years even, and it's just not working, and they have to close shop and lay off their employees, right? That happens. You need to have this option of innovation and experimentation because we don't know what the right thing is. We gotta have that freedom of entry, and some people are gonna fail, and that's fine. That, in a healthy economy, if nobody ever failed, that means we're not trying enough new businesses, right? So that's fine, but what's weird is why is it that it seems every once in a while, like every 7 or 8 years typically, a bunch of businesses all simultaneously say, whoa, we were, you know, overly optimistic, and they all cut back at the same time, so the unemployment rate shoots up to 8-9%. Why does that happen? That's the thing that the Austrians were trying to explain. Okay, so that's the basic theory. Let me now sort of apply that framework in our current context. So here, I don't know how well you can see this in the back. What I'm trying to show you here is that since the so-called recovery that occurred in the Obama administration when the stock market started taking off. Okay, so the blue line here is the S&P 500 index. You can see that it went hand in hand with this red line. The red line is the total assets held by the Federal Reserve. Okay, so you can see the QE2, notice that the red line went up and then it was flat. Then they did QE3, which stands for quantitative easing. When this red line tapers off, right, that's the so-called taper period when the Fed slowed its asset purchases. And so I don't know if you know this, but from the fall of 2014 until fairly recently, this is the Trump election, the Fed was just treading water. Okay, so it actually, even though people would talk about, oh, the crazy inflation of Janet Yellen, no, actually under Yellen, the Fed slowed its asset purchases and was just treading water, just rolling over its bonds so that its balance sheet stayed the same size. And then what happened, late 2017 all through 2018, is the Fed actually started selling off assets. So that's why this came down. So you'll notice, up until Trump's election, there was a pretty tight connection between the stock market index and the Fed's balance sheet. Obviously, the units, you know, are adjusted so that those things fit. But I didn't have to tinker with this. This is like if you just go to FRED, the St. Louis Fed's website, and just plot those two series, they fit hand in glove. I just kind of noticed that on my own and then, you know, realized, oh, wait a minute, there's a certain logic there. So I haven't really, you know, I didn't have to tinker with that to get them to line up like that. You will notice this, again, this vertical line is when Trump gets elected, and there the blue line keeps going up. So I think, you know, whatever you want to say about Trump's personality, I think it's what happened there is that investors who had originally been thinking that there was going to be a Hillary Clinton administration and what she was going to do with taxes and regulations and stuff like that, then all of a sudden, holy cow, Donald Trump won, I can't believe it. And they thought about it for a day or two and then said, you know, he might cut taxes, he might, you know, deregulate. And I think that's why you saw the stock market rise after there. So my big picture view of the stock market is that the huge increase, you know, since after the Great Recession, the financial crisis, that most of that was just built on the Fed creating money, right? Because those rounds of QE, again, the Fed, when the Fed buys assets, it just creates money electronically. It's like if the Fed buys $1 million of bonds from someone, that $1 million, in a sense, just gets created out of nothing and then is added to the reserves in the banking system, and then the Fed takes the $1 million of bonds and puts it on its balance sheet. Okay, so it's a very, in other words, when the Fed writes a check on itself, there's nothing that gets debited. It's just the Fed can buy whatever it wants. The only thing holding it back is its, you know, discretion, that if it causes too much price inflation, people would get upset. But there's no constraint physically or even in terms of the accounting on how much stuff the Fed can buy. But what does happen when the Fed buys something, those dollars in a very legitimate legal sense get created. Okay, so to me, the fact that the stock market kept going up every time the Fed would come on the market and create billions of dollars and inject them in the financial sector, that shouldn't cause us comfort. We shouldn't say, well, at least the stock market's recovering and all those people were worried about the Obama crazy policies. Look at the stock market, it's booming. I would say, yeah, it's booming because the Fed's creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and pumping it into the financial sector. And again, you saw it on the flip side, that when the stock market in like mid-2018 onwards, you know, started really dropping aggressively and then the Fed, you know, backed off, that was precisely when the Fed had accelerated letting its bonds mature. Okay, so I know if you don't have a financial background, some of this stuff is gonna be obscure to you, but the point is, up until, again, late 2017 and then more aggressively in 2018, the Fed, up until that point, had just been rolling over assets, even though they were raising interest rates, and I'm gonna talk about that in a minute. But my point is, the real true Fed tightening of when they were sucking money out of the system didn't occur until 2018. And that's exactly when you saw all the crazy volatility in the stock market and those huge drops. So again, I think this fits the Austrian story very nicely, that the Fed created a bunch of money that gave us an apparent recovery after the, you know, the crisis in 2008. And then as the Fed finally started unwinding that huge intervention, all of a sudden, oh gee, the stock market's in trouble. Okay, another completely independent line of thought. So where I'm going with this is to say, I think the Fed blew up a giant asset bubble and a crash is inevitable. And so I'm just giving you another line of argumentation here to show you that this, you know, isn't merely like, oh, I hate the government. I do hate the government, just so you know. But I'm saying I can give you other reasons. Okay, so the yield, you know what? I don't want to ignore you people. I'll go over here for this one. So the yield curve is close to inverting. And so, again, what does the yield curve mean if you never heard the term. So bonds have, they can be arranged by maturity, right? So you can buy like a 1 month bond, a 3 month bond. So you're in effect lending money to an institution and they're gonna pay you back on some date in the future. And typically under a normal yield curve, the annualized rate of return or the yield you're getting on that loan is higher the longer your money is tied up, right? So you're gonna get a higher rate of return even measured per year if you buy a 30-year treasury than if you buy a 3 month treasury, right? So if you're in effect lending Uncle Sam money for 30 years, you're gonna typically get a higher rate of return on that than a 3 month loan. Okay, so that's what a normal yield curve is. So this line here is showing the difference between the 10-year treasury and the 3 month treasury. Okay, so you can see the axis, it's like up to 4 percentage points. So the idea is when this line is high, that's saying that the interest rate you're effectively getting on a 10-year loan to the government is that much higher than what the interest rate you're getting on a 3 month loan, okay? So when the yield curve inverts, that's saying that actually it's negative, meaning in those rare occasions, the interest rate on a 3 month T-bill is higher than what you're getting on a 10-year. Okay, and so that when that happens, that's when this blue line goes below this black line. Okay, so you notice it's a rare thing. Typically, the yield curve is positive, but notice occasionally it does invert. And also notice whenever that happens, it's right before these gray bar lines are recessions. So when the yield curve inverts, then there's typically a recession that follows soon after. Okay, so this is a well-known phenomenon in financial circles, like people in the bond markets, they know this. It's been true at least since World War II. If you define the yield curve properly, you can get it so that it's perfect, right? That every time there's a recession, the yield curve has previously inverted, and every time the yield curve inverts, there's gonna be a recession pretty soon, right? So there's no false negatives or false positives if you define it right. So, one thing is notice it's very close to inverting again. Okay, so if you're looking at the news, you'll see people talking about, uh-oh, the yield curve is gonna invert in 2019. This is what they're talking about. So notice, just as an objective thing, this is one more line of evidence showing a recession is in the offing or could be if this thing keeps going down. And then I also think it ties in well with standard Austrian business cycle theory, right? So it's not that Mises or Hayek, to my knowledge, talked about this phenomenon, but I'm saying knowing their view, this kind of makes sense, right? Because when the Fed floods the economy with cheap credit, that's gonna push short-term rates down more than it will affect long-term rates. The Fed has more control over short rates, so that's why when there's an inflationary boom, you would expect the yield curve to be really positive, right? Because the short rates get pushed low, the long rates either don't fall that much or they could even go up if people are expecting more price inflation. So in long-term yields, they're building in that price component. And then when the Fed slams on the brakes, it's mostly short rates that spike up, whereas long rates, again, it doesn't have as much control over. So I would interpret that and say, yeah, with those periods where the yield curve inverted is when the Fed was slamming on the brakes, and that's why you saw interest rates flip like that. So that makes, total sense in terms of the Austrian theory that this is the way, the pattern you would see. And so again, notice, again, just another objective line of argumentation to show you that things look like a recession is imminent. So if that continued and went negative, then you would think within 12 months there would be a recession. Okay, and then the last slide I want to walk you through here has to do with bank reserves. So the point of this is to say that the Fed has painted itself into a corner, because the obvious question is to say, okay, well, if the Fed blows up this bubble, why doesn't it just keep blowing it up? Right? Why ever take away the punch bowl, to use that metaphor? And the standard answer was, well, because eventually price inflation gets out of hand and they have to raise rates. But here there's another element going on, and this ties together a few strands of discussion that I've been making to audiences over the years here. And so let me just try to boil it down. I got about 5 minutes left here, and then we have a little time for questions. So the bank reserves, what that means, the commercial banks, when you go and give like a $1,000 deposit at your Bank of America, okay, there's legal requirements that they have to put aside a certain amount of that to be held in reserve, like backing up your account, all right? And so let's say it's 10%. So they have to keep $100 of that on reserve, and then they're allowed to lend out the other 900. okay? And so that's why bank runs are possible. If everybody shows up tomorrow at Bank of America, well, it's Sunday. If everyone shows up on Monday at Bank of America to take all their money, you guys know that they're not gonna have it, right? So that's because the reserves aren't 100%. All right, so that's the way the system works. So what's happened is, in the wake of the financial crisis, because the Fed created so much money, and partly because the economy was still so bad, the banks actually let their reserves pile up. They didn't lend more money on top of it, which is normally what happens. So you can see, historically, bank reserves are very low. Like it's not that the graph is missing, it's just it's hugging the black line, right? It's only here, you can see, in the midst of the 2008-2009 Great Recession, that all of a sudden the bank reserves shoot up. And I don't know if you can read the axis here, but it's over $2 trillion up there. Okay, so that it's not a little bit of money. It's a lot of, it's $2 trillion in reserves are shot up. And then it's been coming down. So again, you can see this upshot goes hand in hand with the booming stock market. And then you can see more recently is the bank reserves have been draining out. That's also when the stock market's been declining. So again, just another confirmation of that pattern. But another thing going on here is that what the Fed started doing in the fall of 2008, and again, this goes to show you how the people in charge, it's not just that what they're doing is sort of beside the point, it's the exact opposite often of what they're telling the public. So you may remember, the fall of Lehman Brothers, the Fed takes over AIG, Hank Paulson, who was George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, right? He literally, I don't know if you guys remember, he literally got down on a knee and was begging Nancy Pelosi for the TARP bailout funds, okay? Because they were assuring Americans that, yeah, we have to bail out all these big banks that engage in mortgage-backed securities, and they bought credit default swaps and all this other stuff. And it pains them to do it. They hate bailing out billionaires, but they needed to do it, and this was the phrase they used. They said, we need to bail out Wall Street to keep credit flowing to Main Street. I don't know if you guys remembered that or you heard some permutation of that. So the idea was, yes, we have to bail out these people because otherwise your ATM's not gonna work. Otherwise you go to get a mortgage, the bank's gonna turn you away. We can't have that happen. And so unfortunately, regrettably, we have to bail out all our buddies. And so that's the logic they gave. So in that context, it's surprising when I tell audiences that in October of 2008, right, so 1 month after the crisis really hit, the Fed initiated a new policy. And the new policy was the Fed was going to pay banks to not make loans to their customers. Now, that's not how they described it, but that is what they were doing. So the more neutral antiseptic term, it was called the program of paying interest on reserves. So if you go Google that, you can read the Federal Reserve talking about it very matter-of-factly. And so what it was is the Fed's buying a bunch of assets, pumping in bank reserves. Normally, that would push down interest rates, and the Fed wanted to be able to set those two things independently. The Fed wanted to be able to set interest rates at whatever it thought the appropriate level was, and it wanted to be able to buy and sell assets at whatever level it thought in terms of bailing out the mortgage sector or what have you. And it didn't want those two things to pin down the other. So the way the Fed was going to be able to raise interest rates without selling off assets was to start itself paying banks, saying, if you leave money on deposit with us, your reserves, instead of lending it out to your customers, we, the Fed, will pay you, the banks, interest. So that was a new policy that they started in October of 2008, and that explains why they're in a bit of a pickle now, and they sort of had to start letting their balance sheet roll off, because as the interest rates have been rising, that means the Fed, in order to keep the banks, keep them wanting to keep the reserves parked with the Fed rather than lending them out the market rate of interest, the Fed has to pay more and more to the banks. So when I ran these numbers, it was at 2.4%, right? So right now the Federal Reserve is paying the commercial banks the annualized rate of 2.4% for keeping reserves parked with the Fed rather than lending them out to the bank, to the general public. And right now, or at least when I grab this slide, the total reserves still in the system were 1.6 trillion. So that means right now the Fed is paying the banks at the rate of $39 billion annually just to keep their money parked at the Fed. All right, so I think, for one thing, it's expensive. As they keep raising interest rates, it gets more and more expensive. But also, that could be construed as diverting taxpayer funds, right? Because the Fed, it earns income, and then whatever's left over after its expenses, it remits to the Treasury. So the fact that $39 billion had to be paid to the banks, in a very real sense, is $39 billion less that the Treasury has to spend. So that means, you know, the deficit's higher or spending is lower than it otherwise would be. Okay, so I think, especially in the going forward in the political climate, if Ocasio-Cortez or other people realize what's going on here, and they say, by the way, do you know that right now they're paying $39 billion to the banks to not make loans to the public? I don't think that's going to withstand scrutiny. And so I think partly that's why the Fed has to start shrinking its balance sheet. So I think for all these different reasons, they can't avoid continuing to raise rates and to let assets sell off. And that's why I do think, unfortunately, they blew up a big bubble. And I think a big crash is inevitable. And so that's where we stand. So with that happy thought, I will thank you. Thanks for your attention.